The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Book 1, Chapter 8. The End of the World. I was once sitting on a summer day in a meadow in Kent, under the shadow of a little village church, with a rather curious companion with whom I had just been walking through the woods. He was one of a group of eccentrics I had come across in my wanderings, who had a new religion called Higher Thought, in which I had been so far initiated as to realize a general atmosphere of loftiness or height, and was hoping at some later and more esoteric stage to discover the beginnings of thought. My companion was the most amusing of them, for however he may have stood towards thought, he was at least very much their superior in experience, having travelled beyond the tropics while they were meditating in the suburbs, though he had been charged with excess in telling travellers' tales. In spite of anything said against him, I preferred him to his companions, and willingly went with him through the wood, where I could not but feel that his sunburnt face and fierce tufted eyebrows and pointed beard gave him something of the look of Pan. Then we sat down in the meadow, and gazed idly at the treetops and the spire of the village church, while the warm afternoon began to mellow into early evening, and the song of a speck of a bird was faint far up in the sky, and no more than a whisper of breeze soothed, rather than stirred, the ancient orchards of the Garden of England. Then my companion said to me, "Do you know why the spire of that church goes up like that?" I expressed a respectable agnosticism, and he answered in an offhand way, "Oh, the same as the obelisks, the phallic worship of antiquity." Then I looked across at him suddenly as he lay there leering above his goat-like beard, and for the moment I thought he was not Pan, but the devil. No mortal words can express the immense, the insane incongruity and unnatural perversion of thought involved in saying such a thing at such a moment and in such a place. For one moment I was in the mood in which men burned witches. And then a sense of absurdity equally enormous seemed to open about me like a dawn. "Why, of course," I said, after a moment's reflection. "If it hadn't been for phallic worship, they would have built the spire pointing downwards and standing on its own apex." I could have sat in that field and laughed for an hour. My friend did not seem offended, for indeed he was never thin-skinned about his scientific discoveries. I had only met him by chance, and I never met him again, and I believe he is now dead. But though it has nothing to do with this argument, it may be worthwhile to mention the name of this adherent of higher thought and interpreter of primitive religious origins, or at any rate the name by which he was known. It was Louis de Rougemont. That insane image of the Kentish church standing on the point of its spire, as in some old rustic topsy-turvy tale, always comes back into my imagination when I hear these things said of pagan origins, and calls to my aid the laughter of the giants. Then I feel as genially and charitably to all other scientific investigators as I do to poor Louis de Rougemont. But the memory of that immense absurdity remains as a sort of measure and check by which to keep sane, not only on the subject of Christian churches, but also on the subject of heathen temples. Now, a great many people have talked about heathen origins as the distinguished traveller talked about Christian origins. Indeed, a great many modern heathens have been very hard on heathenism. A great many modern humanitarians have been very hard on the real religion of humanity. They have represented it as being everywhere, and from the first, rooted only in these repulsive arcana, and carrying the character of something utterly shameless and anarchical. Now, I do not believe this for a moment. I should never dream about thinking about the whole worship of Apollo, what de Rougemont could think about the worship of Christ. I would never admit that there was such an atmosphere in a Greek city as that madman was able to smell in a Kentish village. On the contrary, it is the whole point, even of this final chapter upon the final decay of paganism, to insist once more that the worst sort of paganism had already been defeated by the best sort. It was the best sort of paganism that wore the laurels of Rome. It was the best thing that the world had yet seen, all things considered and on any large scale, that ruled from the wall of the Grampians to the garden of the Euphrates. It was the best that conquered. It was the best that ruled. And it was the best that began to decay. Unless this broad truth be grasped, the whole story is seen askew. Pessimism is not in being tired of evil, but in being tired of good. Despair does not lie in being weary of suffering, but in being weary of joy. It is when, for some reason or other, the good things in a society no longer work, that the society begins to decline. When its food does not feed, when its cures do not cure, when its blessings refuse to bless. We might almost say that in a society without such good things, we should hardly have any test by which to register a decline. That is why some of the static commercial oligarchies, like Carthage, have rather an air in history of standing and staring like mummies, so dried up and swathed and embalmed that no man knows when they are new or old. But Carthage, at any rate, was dead, and the worst assault ever made by the demons upon mortal society had been defeated. But how much would it matter that the worst was dead, if the best was dying? To begin with, it must be noted that the relation of Rome to Carthage was partially repeated and extended in her relation to nations more normal and more nearly akin to her than Carthage. I am not here concerned to controvert the merely political view that Roman statesmen acted unscrupulously towards Corinth or the Greek cities. But I am concerned to contradict the notion that there was nothing but a hypocritical excuse in the ordinary Roman dislike of Greek cities. I am not presenting these pagans as paladins of chivalry, with a sentiment about nationalism never known until Christian times. But I am presenting them as men, with the feelings of men, and those feelings were not a pretense. The truth is that one of the weaknesses in nature worship and mere mythology had already produced a perversion among the Greeks due to the worst sophistry, the sophistry of simplicity. Just as they became unnatural by worshipping nature, so they actually became unmanly by worshipping man. If Greece led her conqueror, she might have misled her conqueror. But these were things he did originally wish to conquer, even in himself. It is true that in one sense there was less inhumanity even in Sodom and Gomorrah than in Tyre and Sidon. When we consider the war of the demons on the children, we cannot compare even Greek decadence to Punic devil worship. But it is not true that the sincere revulsion from either need be merely pure Pharisaical. It is not true to human nature or to common sense. Let any lad who has had the luck to grow up sane and simple in his daydreams of love hear for the first time of the cult of Ganymede, he will not merely be shocked but sickened. And that first impression, as has been said here so often about first impressions, will be right. Our cynical indifference is an illusion. It is the greatest of all illusions, the illusion of familiarity. It is right to conceive the more or less rustic virtues of the ruck of the ordinary Romans as reacting against the very rumor of it with complete spontaneity and sincerity. It is right to regard them as reacting, if in a lesser degree, exactly as they did against the cruelty of Carthage. Because it was in a less degree, they did not destroy Corinth as they destroyed Carthage. But if their attitude and action was rather destructive, in neither case need their indignation have been mere self-righteousness covering mere selfishness. And if anybody insists that nothing could have operated in either case but reasons of state and commercial conspiracies, we can only tell him that there is something which he does not understand, something which possibly he will never understand, something which, until he does understand, he will never understand the Latins. That something is called democracy. He has probably heard the word a good many times, and even used it himself, but he has no notion what it means. All through the revolutionary history of Rome, there was an incessant drive towards democracy. The state and the statesman could do nothing without a considerable backing of democracy, the sort of democracy that never has anything to do with diplomacy. It is precisely because of the presence of Roman democracy that we hear so much about Roman oligarchy. For instance, recent historians have tried to explain the valor and victory of Rome in terms of that detestable and detested usury which was practiced by some of the patricians. As if Curius had conquered the men of the Macedonian phalanx by lending them money, or the consul Nero had negotiated the victory of Metaurus at 5%. But we realize the usury of the patricians because of the perpetual revolt of the plebeians. The rule of the Punic merchant princes has the very soul of usury. But there was never a Punic mob that dared to call them usurers. Burdened, like all mortal things, with all mortal sin and weakness, the rise of Rome had really been the rise of normal, and especially of popular things, and in nothing more than in the thoroughly normal and profoundly popular hatred of perversion. Now, among the Greeks, a perversion had become a convention. It is true that it had become so much of a convention, especially a literary convention, that it was sometimes conventionally copied by Roman literary men. But this is one of those complications that always arise out of conventions. It must not obscure our sense of the difference in tone in the two societies as a whole. It is true that Virgil would once, in a way, take over a theme of Theocritus, but nobody can get the impression that Virgil was particularly fond of that theme. The themes of Virgil were specially and notably the normal themes, and nowhere more than in morals, piety and patriotism, and the honor of the countryside. And we may well pause upon the name of the poet as we pass into the autumn of antiquity, upon his name, who was in so supreme a sense the very voice of autumn, of its maturity and its melancholy, of its fruits of fulfillment and its prospect of decay. Nobody who reads even a few lines of Virgil can doubt that he understood what moral sanity means to mankind. Nobody can doubt his feelings when the demons were driven in flight before the household gods. But there are two particular points about him and his work which are particularly important to the main thesis here. The first is that the whole of his great patriotic epic is in a very peculiar sense founded upon the fall of Troy, that is, upon an avowed pride in Troy, although she had fallen. In tracing to Trojans the foundation of his beloved race and republic, he began what may be called the great Trojan tradition, which runs through medieval and modern history. We have already seen the first hint of it in the pathos of Homer about Hector. But Virgil turned it not merely into a literature, but into a legend. And it was a legend of the almost divine dignity that belongs to the defeated. This was one of the traditions that did truly prepare the world for the coming of Christianity, and especially of Christian chivalry. This is what did help to sustain civilization through the incessant defeats of the Dark Ages and the barbarian wars, out of which what we call chivalry was born. It is the moral attitude of the man with his back to the wall, and it was the wall of Troy. All through medieval and modern times, this version of the virtues in the Homeric conflict can be traced in 100 ways, cooperating with all that was akin to it in Christian sentiment. Our own countrymen, and the men of other countries, loved to claim, like Virgil, that their own nation was descended from the heroic Trojans. All sorts of people thought it the most superb sort of heraldry to claim to be descended from Hector. Nobody seems to have wanted to be descended from Achilles. The very fact that the Trojan name has become a Christian name and been scattered to the last limits of Christendom, to Ireland or the Gaelic Highlands, while the Greek name has remained relatively rare and pedantic, is a tribute to the same truth. Indeed, it involves a curiosity of language almost in the nature of a joke. The name has been turned into a verb, and the very phrase about hectoring in the sense of swaggering suggests the myriads of soldiers who have taken the fallen Trojan for a model. As a matter of fact, nobody in antiquity was less given to hectoring than Hector. But even the bully pretending to be a conqueror took his title from the conquered. That is why the popularization of the Trojan origin by Virgil has a vital relation to all those elements that have made men say that Virgil was almost a Christian. It is almost as if two great tools or toys of the same timber, the divine and the human, had been in the hands of Providence, and the only thing comparable to the wooden cross of Calvary was the wooden horse of Troy. So, in some wild allegory, pious in purpose, if almost profane in form, the holy child might have fought the dragon with a wooden sword and a wooden horse. The other element in Virgil which is essential to the argument is the particular nature of his relation to mythology, or what may here, in a special sense, be called folklore, the faiths and fancies of the populace. Everybody knows that his poetry at its most perfect is less concerned with the pomposity of Olympus than with the noumena of natural and agricultural life. Everyone knows where Virgil looked for the causes of things. He speaks of finding them not so much in cosmic allegories of Uranus and Kronos, but rather in Pan and the sisterhood of the nymphs and Silvanus, the old man of the forest. He is perhaps most himself in some passages of the Eclogues, in which he has perpetuated forever the great legend of Arcadia and the shepherds. Here again it is easy enough to miss the point with petty criticism about all the things that happen to separate his literary convention from ours. There is nothing more artificial than the cry of artificiality as directed against the old pastoral poetry. We have entirely missed all that our fathers meant by looking at the externals of what they wrote. People have been so much amused with the mere fact that the China Shepherdess was made of China that they have not even asked why she was made at all. They have been so content to consider the merry peasant as a figure in an opera that they have not asked even how he came to go to the opera, or how he strayed onto the stage. In short, one has only to ask why there is a China shepherdess and not a China shopkeeper. Why were not mantelpieces adorned with figures of city merchants in elegant attitudes, of iron masters wrought in iron, or gold speculators in gold? Why did the opera exhibit a merry peasant and not a merry politician? Why was there not a ballet of bankers, pirouetting upon pointed toes? Because the ancient instinct and humor of humanity have always told them, under whatever conventions, that the conventions of complex cities were less really healthy and happy than the customs of the countryside. So it is with the eternity of the eclogues. A modern poet did indeed write things called Fleet Street eclogues, in which poets took the place of the shepherds. But nobody has yet written anything called Wall Street eclogues, in which millionaires should take the place of the poets. And the reason is that there is a real, if only a recurrent, yearning for that sort of simplicity, and there is never that sort of yearning for that sort of complexity. The key to the mystery of the merry peasant is that the peasant often is merry. Those who do not believe it are simply those who do not know anything about him, and therefore do not know which are his times for merriment. Those who do not believe in the shepherd's feast or song are merely ignorant of the shepherd's calendar. The real shepherd is indeed very different from the ideal shepherd, but that is no reason for forgetting the reality at the root of the ideal. It needs a truth to make a tradition. It needs a tradition to make a convention. Pastoral poetry is certainly often a convention, especially in a social decline. It was in a social decline that Watteau shepherds and shepherdesses lounged about the gardens of Versailles. It was also in a social decline that shepherds and shepherdesses continued to pipe and dance through the most faded imitations of Virgil. But that is no reason for dismissing the dying paganism without ever understanding its life. It is no reason for forgetting that the very word pagan is the same as the word peasant. We may say that this art is only artificiality, but it is not a love of the artificial. On the contrary, it is in its very nature only the failure of nature worship, or the love of the natural. For the shepherds were dying because their gods were dying. Paganism lived upon poetry, that poetry already considered under the name of mythology. But everywhere, and especially in Italy, it had been a mythology and a poetry rooted in the countryside, and that rustic religion had been largely responsible for the rustic happiness. Only as the whole society grew in age and experience, there began to appear that weakness in all mythology already noted in the chapter under that name. This religion was not quite a religion. In other words, this religion was not quite a reality. It was the young world's riot with images and ideas, like a young man's riot with wine and lovemaking. It was not so much immoral as irresponsible. It had no foresight of the final test of time. Because it was creative to any extent, it was credulous to any extent. It belonged to the artistic side of man. Yet, even considered artistically, it had long become overloaded and entangled. The family trees sprung from the seed of Jupiter were a jungle rather than a forest. The claims of the gods and demigods seemed like things to be settled rather by a lawyer or a professional herald than by a poet. But it is needless to say that it was not only in the artistic sense that these things had grown more anarchic. There had appeared in more and more flagrant fashion that flower of evil that is really implicit in the very seed of nature worship, however natural it may seem. I have said that I do not believe that natural worship necessarily begins with this particular passion. I am not of the De Rougemont school of scientific folklore. I do not believe that mythology must begin with eroticism. But I do believe that mythology must end in it. I am quite certain that mythology did end in it. Moreover, not only did the poetry grow more immoral, but the immorality grew more indefensible. Greek vices, Oriental vices, hints of the old horrors of the Semitic demons, began to fill the fancies of decaying Rome, swarming like flies on a dung heap. The psychology of it is really human enough to anyone who will try that experiment of seeing history from the inside. There comes an hour in the afternoon when the child is tired of pretending, when he is weary of being a robber or a Red Indian. It is then that he torments the cat. There comes a time in the routine of ordered civilization when a man is tired of playing at mythology and pretending that a tree is a maiden or that the moon made love to a man. The effect of all this staleness is the same everywhere. It is seen in all drug-taking and dram-drinking and every form of the tendency to increase the dose. Men seek stranger sins or more startling obscenities as stimulants to their jaded senses. They seek after mad Oriental religions for the same reason. They try to stab their nerves to life, if it were with the knives of the priests of Baal. They are walking in their sleep and try to wake themselves up with nightmares. End of part 1 of chapter 8.